honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 99-year-old Jack Kappeler of Bakersfield, California. We've already learned quite a bit today, like how neon lights came to the U.S. It was Jack's father who had that first contract with Electrical Products Corporation, responsible for more familiar signs for you than you probably even realize. Jack's brother Frank was one of the Doolittle Raiders, a navigator who later became a bombardier and made it a career in the Air Force. And wanting to be a little different, Jack decided to do his flying in the Navy, eventually piloting F-6F Hellcat and F-4U Corsair fighters. He mentioned still being in touch with his wingman. And if you've enjoyed the revival of the Top Gun movie franchise with the new film Maverick, or maybe you're just a fan of the original, you might find it interesting the call sign that Jack's wingman carried.
Yeah, Art Lindelman, Goose Lindelman. He's from Goose Creek, Texas. That was his call, Goose.
So long before this Top Gun movie, decades later, your wingman was Goose.
Oh, did they have a Goose in that?
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't from Goose Creek, though.
No.
Are there some memories you have of where Goose was really important to you, or vice versa, where you guys had to be there for each other in a way that was out of the ordinary?
Many times, but I can't recall any one particular one that would be above the others. Sometimes you'd have an emergency where he'd come to stay by your side, and you'd go in and make the landing, and one plane would make it, and then he would have to ditch or something, and he was there to protect you or make sure you got down. He's the one that had the problem. That happened many times, yeah.
Well, give me a taste of that. What kind of emergencies are we talking about here?
Engines, when you have gunfire going into your plane, you have engines with parts probably trying to fall off. And when they start vibrating and shaking, you know something's wrong.
And you're saying that from firsthand experience?
Yes, ma'am.
So I got to ask you a little more about that here. Tell me what happened. You got shot up and your engine was going out on you?
I've had that a few times, yeah. A lot of times it can happen. You make a strafing run, and you don't even know whether you were hit or not while you're making it. But on your way home, you find out you're losing half your cylinders, and the engine's starting to act up.
So you're trying to get back to your carrier, and all of a sudden you're sputtering a little bit?
Yeah, and you're with your wingman. The two of you sputter together.
And are you starting to contemplate having to bail out?
Yeah, first thing, you don't bail out if you can help it. You make a water landing.
Ditch in the water and hope someone's there to pick you up.
Stay there with the plane as long as you can, as long as it floats, yeah.
How close do you think you came to having to do that?
Oh, a few times, I guess, but never actually had to do it.
So in a scenario like that, your wingman can fly next to you and try to give you a visual on what you can't see?
Oh, no, he can't. You have a hard time talking the last minutes.
Yeah.
The wingman's just there to make sure he gets down all right, gets out of the cockpit, and stays long enough to guide somebody in to pick you up, yeah.
Well, I know this sounds kind of like a cliche, but it seems like everybody's got an answer to it. You know, whether guys were in the air or on the ground or in the water, seems like everybody remembers a closest call or a moment where it could have been them. Is there a moment for you that you look back on and say, hey, that was my closest call?
Not really, no. I had many, many, and they all seem to be close.
Yeah?
No, there was not one that was worse than the others.
How'd you lose your two front teeth?
If I didn't have my tail hooked, you're going into a barrier at about 130. Pull your shoulder straps down, tighten up, and put your seat as low as it'll go. Protect your head.
You're saying this like this is no big deal, but this is life and death.
It happened. You have to. What do you do?
So you knew your tail hook had broken off?
Well, yeah, you knew that your wingman would tell you what your tail hook looked like, yeah.
So you're radioing in, I have no tail hook, you need to put the net up, the barrier?
They have a barrier, yeah, that automatically put it up when they know you're coming in. They do that in a matter of minutes.
But then you still have to do it. I can only imagine what goes through your mind, because you've never done this before.
No, you don't practice it.
Yeah, I don't know what the statistics would be if they did practice that.
You want to keep the plane slow enough, right above stall speed, that you're not going to be tearing the whole airplane apart with you in it.
So I'd really love to know what those few moments were like for you, because you know this is not going to be pretty. It's not going to be normal. It's not going to be safe or easy. What goes through your mind as you're approaching that runway?
So fast you don't have a chance to think about it. It's there and then it's over with.
So I think maybe some of us imagine closing our eyes, clenching our teeth, saying a prayer, doing something.
No, I didn't have a chance to do that.
Yeah. And what did it feel like?
I can't tell you.
You know, every day for the last, 77 years, you've had what I'm sure is a reminder of this because what it did to your teeth. So what happened to your teeth? What caused that?
When your shoulder straps break, it went right into the dash and it hit me in the mouth. Mm-hmm. And pushed my upper teeth back.
It's like somebody punched you in the mouth.
Yeah, doing 130 miles an hour and then you come to a stop.
Did that knock you unconscious?
Well, probably could you. I didn't know. Probably stuns you, sure.
And you've seen pictures of what your plane looked like after that.
Yeah, saw pictures of my face.
What do you think of when you see those photos?
Horrible. Why would a guy do this?
You know, whether it was that rough landing on the carrier that cost you your teeth or other close calls, because you said you had several, have you ever looked back and realized, hey, if that didn't work out that way, there's four kids and six grandkids and now great grandkids who wouldn't be here?
Never thought of that. No, I hadn't got that far in life.
Maybe when you hit 100 in a few months, you'll think that.
It was just me at that time.
Yep.
Me.
So I want to talk about this dropping supplies, relief for prisoners of war. Yeah. Your brother could have easily become a prisoner of war, or he probably would have been executed if he was caught by the Japanese at that point. When they told you you were going to be dropping supplies for prisoners of war, did that feel different from your bombing and strafing missions?
Probably felt more important, thinking you're helping some of the guys down there. And at that time, whoever knew I was dropping supplies to a college professor, it would be one of my professors.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, my paleo professor, Dr. Kleinfeld, was a prisoner of war in the Marianas with his wife. And he was in a prisoner of war camp there. We flew in and dropped packages, each one of them. And he had the Lexington planes marked. So when I got into school, he asked me if I was there. And I was dropping packages to he and his wife at the time, he figured out.
How about that?
Yeah, Dr. Kleinfeld, he was a heck of a professor.
So he was probably a POW for a long time.
Long time, and his wife with him. They didn't treat the wives very well. A lot of them were out there working. Yeah, he was doing research in paleontology in the Philippines.
And is that something you guys did a lot of, or just once, or how many times did you do that?
I had it a few times, a couple times, I guess.
I want to put all the pieces of that puzzle together. At the time, you're just a Navy flyer, and you probably had a whole squadron of Corsairs that are going over and dropping stuff, right? Would you drop it just like a bomb, or how would you do it?
Yeah, they had a rack, just like a little parachute, not very heavy, 50 pounds maybe, that if it hit them, it isn't going to kill them.
Well, I've had prisoners of war tell me they saw that. They saw guys killed by supplies dropped.
Yeah, you had to be careful.
I should ask you, too, do you remember what it felt like when you found out Japan had surrendered and this was all over?
Oh, it was a relief, yeah. We were all expecting it. They kept going day after day, the word would get out, the war is over, and it wouldn't be. It'd go on for another week or two.
Yeah.
You got used to it.
Was there any celebration aboard your ship when it finally happened?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, everybody rah-rah, and it didn't last too long. I knew it was going to happen, yeah.
And what were you thinking when the war was over? Did you have an idea of what your future looked like?
Never thought about that. Just get the heck out of here and get home.
What was it like to come home?
Wonderful, yeah. I had a brother who was already home and family dog and everything the way it should be.
And then, like so many veterans from World War II, you took advantage of the GI Bill and went to college. And you went to University of California?
Berkeley, yeah, which I had been in before.
And what'd you major in?
Engineering originally. I switched to geology with the professor who had been overseas and a paleontologist.
So you're just a student in this class, but your professor has a little story. How did that come about? What was your first clue that there was something unique here?
He kept needling me as, where were you and where had you been? And it turns out I'd been the same place as he was.
So he had, when he was a prisoner, before he was liberated, supplies were dropped. And it said on there, from the USS Lexington?
I guess, yeah.
So you're in the class,
yeah.
And he tells you, hey, I'm one of those guys that you dropped the supplies to.
Well, he'd be telling us before I told him.
Okay.
He might have asked how many were in the service and what did you do and where were you? He'd ask what planes we were on, and the planes are clearly marked so you know where they're from. And he said, yes, we had to let come in and drop supplies to us. And were you on that? And I said, yeah, probably was. His wife went through hell, the prisoner of war in Japan. Yeah. And he didn't do it. He was out doing paleo in the Marianas.
Right.
And they were pulled in and stuck in a prison. Yeah.
Did he share much about that experience with you guys?
Not much. No, it was murder, terrible. Well, having a wife that you're supposed to be defending and taking care of, the Japanese did whatever they want with her, and that was heck to live with, to know what was going on. Bob Kleinpill.
Sounds like he made a real impression on you.
He did, yeah.
And so you got your degree in geology, and then what'd you do?
I went to work for Tidewater right from the beginning.
But you were still flying.
Oh, I flew in the reserve. Yeah.
Why was that something you wanted to do? Was it just for the money or was it for the kicks?
Both. No, I like to fly, yeah.
And what all did you get to fly in the reserves?
When jets came in, I got the first jets to fly. Reserve got the worst pickings, what was left. The active group got all the new aircraft. And anything they could salvage, we got in the reserve. But I enjoyed every day of it, yeah. A lot of good buddies. And they were all in the same boat I was, from school into the reserve, yeah.
So can you help us understand how big a difference it made going from a propeller-driven Navy fighter to a jet?
Oh, yeah, it was everything you could ever imagine, from 400 miles an hour to 650, yeah.
Did that make it easier on you or tougher?
It's easy in some ways and tougher in others. You had to think faster and get out of your own way. But it was easier, actually. They'd fly themselves.
And so you're flying in the reserves on the weekend, but you're working in the oil industry. What exactly did you do, and how did that fit into the big picture?
How did I use that plane to...
No, in your job with the oil, what did you do for the oil company?
I mapped to look for oil, and I did use the plane in the reserve on the Sundays. I'd go out and map an area, and then I'd go Sunday and check it out in the Navy plane with the area I mapped to see if it was as accurate as what I had seen. So the military helped me then in that way, yeah.
So the oil industry owes the Navy a little.
They do.
Uh-huh. Too bad he didn't have ground-penetrating radar, huh?
I'd be in trouble.
I don't know if this is an easy question to answer or not, because you flew a lot of different aircraft. If you could, tomorrow, get up and hop in the cockpit and fly any plane, what would that plane be?
The last one I flew was the A4, the little jet. That's the nicest one I ever flew, I guess.
So if the Corsair were sitting next to it, you'd say, no, I'd rather have the A4?
Yeah, the Corsair couldn't do anything compared to a jet, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We didn't talk about the Corsair all that much in terms of its capabilities. What did you appreciate about flying that plane in combat? What were the pros and cons of it?
I flew the Hellcat more than I flew it. Hellcat was a reliable aircraft with the same engine. Corsair fabric on the outside of it, it wasn't metal. If it took a hit, some of the incendiaries, you'd have fire going on. Mm-hmm. You could lose your whole skin of your airplane, the wings. They're more dangerous to fly the Corsair, but they were fighter. They were more agility to the Corsair than a Hellcat.
More maneuverable?
Yeah, a little faster.
Well, and, you know, four kids, six grandkids, all the great-grandkids. You want to tell me the story of how you met your wife?
Yeah, in high school, I was a president of a men's fraternity. They had a meeting of fraternity and sorority. We had high school sororities and high school fraternities. And as this outgoing president, I had to come in and help administer what was going on. I met my wife that night at the meeting. Never met her before. Her dad owned an ice cream store in town and went to the ice cream store often, but she worked at the counter sometimes, but never knew her, never met her. And that started it, and we started dating.
I do have just a couple more questions, and I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story. You're going to turn 100 in December. I know this isn't an easy question, but when you think back over all of it, I mean, you've got almost 100 years to look back over. Is there something that you would say you're most thankful for or most proud of?
Boy, that's hard to say. I'd have to contemplate that. It all fits together. Not any one incident was any more valuable to me than the other, I don't think. My mother was very valuable in my life to keep me going. She always helped and determined and set me straight.
I bet you got a few letters from her while you were overseas.
Yeah, she was a good writer.
And I know you're not looking for attention and you're not patting yourself on the back, but maybe you'll pat your fellow flyers on the back. What can you tell me about the guys you flew with? What made them special?
close-knit, and some of them I still correspond with. Yeah, we still get together.
Do you think it's important that people today know about World War II and what all you guys did?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Sure. History has its way of returning and doing the same thing again. And if you study it, maybe it won't do the things we did stupidly in World War II. So it serves a lesson, yes.
A lesson we're reminded of each week, with a little different perspective each time. What a treat to get Jack Kappeler's perspective today. Don't forget to explore photos and that short video with Jack at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. Thanks again to Arnold Martinez for letting us know about Jack and his story, and thank you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.